somebody open with a prayer?
All right, you're recording.
Can you do that? I would be happy. Yes, that would be good.
Careful what you say.
Okay.
You're recording.
How are you doing?
Let me go check.
You just tell me when you want to start. And
like probably 1 minute.
All right, 1 minute it is.
Are you going to do the opening prayer?
I am.
Great.
Go up there and actually do it then, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, that'd be great.
So why don't you officially start the podcast?
Good morning. I don't want to spill your coffee. I have this awareness that last week we did a microphone. How is the sound if I speak like this? Can you hear me in the back? Sort of. Can you hear me in the back? So it's a little challenging. John, do we have any miking available back here? I can just speak louder, but I'm just checking. I will speak louder. How's that? Okay. I appreciate Mike and I have known each other for over 30 years.
A long time.
And we're going to talk a little bit about some different things today. And I was watching multiple of you have your coffee. I'm not a coffee drinker, but I get teased all the time about, man, you had too much caffeine today, hon. I don't even drink caffeine. So I don't listen to myself. I don't watch my own videos because I am a little expressive. So yes, you will have to. I am enthusiastic, yes. I am enthusiastic about this topic. Mostly, yeah, this is what I do full time. But I told several people after our first class, this is like heaven to me. This is why I went to get my master's and doctorate was to help my brothers and sisters. Woo! I get emotional just thinking about it, right? I do. I say that because, like, when I can be helpful to somebody that's my spiritual sibling, there's nothing better. There's nothing better. So I'm genuinely, like, so glad you're here, and I hope I can be helpful. And it's okay to ask me questions. I have really good boundaries. If it's a time when it's not a good time for me to talk, or we're in the middle of a service, I'm pretty good at saying, give me a call. But you can always give me a call. You can always send the email. And if I can't talk to you at the moment that you call, I'll let you know. So people are always worried, you know, you're too busy. You can ask me. I'm more than happy to be helpful, because you're my family. So this is a, I teach this at the university is what I'm about to share with you, but this is a 16-week class, 45 hours, and we're going to do it in an hour and a half. So you thought I was energetic last time, but we are just going to cover the tip of the iceberg. I'm just going to describe the entire DSM to you. This is the DSM. So, yeah, this is the fifth edition, 2013 it came out. 14. Doctors have manuals on how to diagnose and so on. They have lots and lots and lots and lots of manuals. They are trained. So medical doctors are trained. Actually, psychiatrists are the creator of the DSM. Psychiatrists are MDs. They are the ones that prescribe medication, right? Everybody else in the world of psychology are PhDs and PsyDs and other Ds. What that means is they're therapists, and they may be a master's level or a doctoral level therapist, and they are trained in this book. This is the diagnostic book for mental health. I'm going to go over almost every one of the things that's in here as far as the actual titles. Next week, we're going to solely focus on all of the anxiety and mood disorders. So I'm barely going to touch on those this week. So just so you know, you're going to feel, this is what happens. Every time I took this class and every time I teach this class, I tell the students, you are going to be diagnosing, like I talked to last time, yourself, every member of your family, everybody in your Bible talk, your spouse, your kids. You're going to be doing that. And just be aware of the tendency to do that. I can't tell you the number of times people come into my office and go, so I have this. And they've looked it all up on the internet, or my husband is this and my wife is this. And they've looked it all up on the internet. So just be aware that you're going to want to diagnose everybody and their brother, but that might not always be the best way to use this information. So this is our topics. This is what we did last time, psychology and Christianity. Today we're talking about understanding mental health throughout the lifespan. So we're going to be looking at the manual. So next week we're doing treatment for anxiety, depression, and suicidality. So all the mood disorders and so on. Thank you. That's probably a good idea. Then the week after that, we're going to focus completely on sex and drugs. We are going to talk about those today very briefly. And then the last week on the practicals of therapy and how to pick somebody and what are some of the challenges. So let's just dive in. This is just a reminder. The word psychology means the study of the soul. The word psychopathology, which that's what this is. It's the manual of disorders, of psychopathology, which is the suffering of the soul. And the reason why I'm putting that up here, and well, let's read Jesus' words. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. So that's often what people are looking for freedom and sight and favor and good news. And Jesus is the answer to that. Amen. You know, as I go through these different diagnoses, some of them have been lampooned in movies and TV, and we do laugh. They've been cartoonized in many different ways. And I just want you to be aware there might be somebody sitting in here that has received that diagnosis and our laughter. I'm not saying, I mean, some of the things I'm actually putting in here are kind of funny, but I'm not saying that laughter is bad, but you just want to be aware that at times we can be dismissive or hurtful in the way we talk about different diagnostic categories and, you know, the way they're made fun of and, you know, exaggerated in media and in our own lives, right? So just be aware that these things that we're going to talk about today, they are very involved in suffering. And so be sensitive and thoughtful to that, not just today, but also when someone comes to you or shares something with you. Some of us have differing levels of comfort with the actual categories we're going to talk about. Or you might know somebody that you've tried to get this through their head, that these things are real, and they have a dismissive response to you. It takes time for people to switch their thinking. It really does. Be patient with people. I told you about how I came into psychology going, I don't believe any of this, right? And it took me a while to embrace a lot of the things that I was learning. So be aware of not just other people's biases, but your own that are going to affect how you feel about some of the things we'll talk about today. Because it's hard. It's hard, some of the things that we'll look at. I love, this is a prediction of Jesus. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. Many of us are this, or we have relationships with somebody that feels this, and we have to imitate Jesus and not bruise and snuff out. 2 Corinthians 1, this is one of my favorite. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves receive from God. This is what I want to be as a therapist, but I think this is what each of us needs to be as a disciple, is that any comfort we have received, we give to others, because we are all needing comfort in the suffering, right? So what are some of the things to pay attention to? What we try to do now is what you'll hear is a biopsychosocial model, but actually as a disciple, we would call it a biopsychosocial spiritual model, meaning we pay attention to all the parts of a person when you're treating them. What does that mean? So bio would be your body, your biological predisposition, your heredity, your hormonal stuff going on, physiology, illness, surgeries, anything that has an impact on your body. So that's the bio part. Psycho means that you're psycho, in case you're wondering. I get asked that all the time. Am I crazy? Somebody yesterday in an appointment, am I crazy? But psycho actually means your temperament and personality, the hardwired parts of your personality, your neurology, and the impact of trauma. So that's all the things having to do with your brain and how it works with your body. Social means the cultural aspects, family, how we were raised, the things you've gone through and endured and seen, your experiences, and trauma. And we're going to talk a little bit about trauma today. And then the spiritual part is we have a sinful nature. We are in great need of a Holy Spirit to live inside of us. We need prayer and Bible study, and we need discipleship. So that's the spiritual end. Well, as a disciple approaching mental health, we need all of these parts. So if you were to apply it to anxiety, say, okay, we're going to talk more about that next week, but if you were to apply those four parts, what does that mean? That means you're going to pay attention to the heredity part. You might have grandma and grandpa and great-grandma and mom having all kinds of different OCD if you're with anxiety, or all kinds of anxiety symptoms, okay? It might come out where illnesses create anxiety symptoms and so on. So your body is very involved in anxiety. It actually literally, the heart rate goes up. Your body literally responds to anxiety. So the bio part, the biopsychosocial, is involved in anxiety. And so when you treat anxiety, you have to pay attention to the biological part. The psychological, so that's the psycho part, is the thoughts, the patterns of thinking, all of the things that have to do with how thinking affects the body and so on. But the way we view ourselves, the beliefs, the meanings that we make of things, that's the psychological part. The social part would be the traumas that you've gone through that have created a PTSD response in your body, or the patterns of social interactions in families, the way families interact that create issues with anxiety in somebody. Immediate circumstances, Okay, for some of you, coming into this room was difficult. So immediate circumstances can create anxiety. And then, yes, when we aren't scripturally grounded, our anxiety can be higher. That doesn't mean that's always a one-for-one, but it can be. If we're not getting enough encouragement, okay, we know that from the scriptures that we need encouragement to keep going and to keep strong. So that can affect anxiety. So when you become a disciple, it deals with those two huge areas, the spiritual part and the social part. It allows you to have this big, huge family that should be and hopefully is supportive. Of course, if it's not, that can all the more traumatize the body. You get to be open with stuff and you get a hopefully loving response in return. The fellowship, one of the biggest things I check with people is how's their support network. You get to hear great lessons, whether it's at a small group or church, and you actually, for the first time, get to base how you live and your morality on the scriptures, not based on the zillions of things out there. So becoming a disciple deals with two of those four categories in a big way. But becoming a disciple doesn't deal with all of the categories necessarily. Now, it can, because maybe you get a deeper conviction about discipline, so you start working out more and your body's healthier, and that helps with anxiety. So that's where they kind of overlap. But it's important that with treatment, so this would be, say, psychological or some other kind of treatment, it helps with the body. It might be, and so that treatment might be therapy. It might be medication. It might be exercise, improving your health. So this is dealing with the body and the brain, the psycho and the bio. Okay, so it's just important that as we look at each of these, that we're not going to look at treatment for all of them. We're going to do that next week and the week after on certain aspects. But all of these, this bio, psycho, social, spiritual, apply to everything that we're going to talk about today. We need needs. We need help in every one of those areas in each of these diagnostic categories. Okay? So what are they? What is the DSM? The thing you have to figure out first is how we feel about the actual titles. So if you went into a doctor and they said you have bipolar disorder, your heart rate would go up tremendously. If they said you have depression, it might not go up as much, because we've watched enough movies that make bipolar sound worse. Or you're borderline. Woo! Your anxiety is just shot out there with, because of how joked that is. Those particular diagnoses, right? But there is actually some positive to having a name, and I want to just talk about that, because professionally it allows communication. I can say to somebody they're dealing with depression. And all of a sudden, they kind of know some of the general things that you're challenged with. It does demystify and validate. So this is the biggest one. I did two different assessment sessions. And in each case, they were like, oh, that actually helps me to have a name. I had an individual who both has GAD, which is generalized anxiety disorder, and OCD, which is obsessive compulsive disorder. And so we were joking in session about her twins. She has twins. And, you know, and it allowed her to actually have a lighter response to her own challenges, to have a name to put to it. Also, it definitely helps with research. You put a name to it, now you can actually start studying it. So in the field of psychology, having a diagnosis is actually pretty helpful. You can measure it, you can compare it to something else, and then you can figure out, is it generalizable to the overall population? Can you apply this to everybody? And this is the biggest one for me, because I'm a clinician, is that then I can go, what are some treatments for? And I can literally start thinking in terms of what specifically is helpful for this issue. So it gives you possibilities and directions, and also, like, even with the twins this week, GAD, generalized anxiety disorder, has a better prognosis than OCD. OCD clings around a bit longer, and so we joked about it's the child that will live with you the rest of your life. You know, GAD might move away. It'll still be in your life, but it might move away, and OCD is going to stay there. And so it's kind of important to know prognosis, because that helps people with how to manage it, how to live with it, how to accept it, how to just you know, go on despite the diagnoses. And today it helps with insurance reimbursement. So there is a lot of politics involved in diagnoses. I'm not going to go into that today. I just want to nod to the fact that it's positive, diagnosing is, but it's got lots of negatives, and it's very influenced by our society and by who's got power. So be aware of that. Okay, this is what's important. Psychiatric diagnoses are actually technically not diseases, because with diseases, you can measure and go, like take a blood test and go, this is what's showing up on their skin or in their blood, and I can measure it and send it to a lab. The only way you can measure, well, there's new with brain research, there's other things that they're pulling in, but mostly what it is syndromes, which means it's a bunch of symptoms, and you go, and so this is true in medical care as well, that they can't measure it. So pain disorders are very much where you can't necessarily take a blood, like they'll say, nothing, no, you're fine. There's nothing wrong with you, but you're experiencing all of this stuff. So they diagnose it. A lot of the autoimmune diseases are diagnosed by you answering their questions. Okay, so it's just important to know that almost all of psychiatric diagnoses are that way, that it's based on the symptoms, not on a blood test. This is important because this affects how you choose what, say, if you're going to take medication, there's no blood test to say what medication you should take. And so medications in psychiatry and psychology are shots in the dark. They are, try this. Oh, shoot, that didn't work very well. Try this. Oh, shoot, that didn't work very well. Try this. And that's, it's different than going to a medical doctor and having a specific syndrome, a specific illness diagnosed. So just be aware of the pieces that affect how we view the diagnosing. So the challenge is there's just more than just biology. Well, with medical illness, there's more than just biology involved too, but especially with psychiatric care. It is predominantly based on just what someone sees or what someone feels or sees in their own life. And it, because of that, it's a little hard to establish that these diagnoses are absolutely true. And when we try to make them absolutely valid and true, there's issues with that because it's so hard to measure it. And so, if you can't measure it, then it doesn't exist. Tends to be how we view psychiatric diagnosing. If you were in my class, I would open this up to discussion. You're not. We don't have 16 weeks. But I want you to think about it because this affects us in different ways. If we can't measure it, then it must not be real. Okay, we do know these things, that if somebody receives a diagnosis early on, then their course is more chronic and the symptoms are more severe. If they receive it later, there is a better prognosis. Now, this is just a blanket statement. This doesn't mean you or the person sitting next to you or your brother at home or yours. And, you know, this is overall, they do know if we catch things earlier, then the problematic way of dealing with it has a lesser chance of developing. In other words, if you have anxiety and you get help as a teenager with it, if it's good help, or as a young adult, instead of waiting till you're 40, you have a better chance of successfully dealing with it, right? So an earlier catching it is a better. Onset actually means when the symptoms start, but also treatment early on makes a difference. So what we do know is that there are certain diagnoses that are adolescent onset, and those are mostly common for anxiety, substance abuse, eating disorders, and some of the personality disorders. So we'll talk about that. There is a big difference, especially in personality disorders, but in others as well, on gender. And that's very socially and culturally constructed. But some of the diagnoses, if you just take the gendered words out, they apply pretty equally across men and women. So there are, let me tell you, from one country to the next, how we view it. You go to China and it's going to be more viewed as a physical illness, and you come to the United States, it's going to be more viewed as a psychiatric illness. So how our culture views these symptoms changes how we diagnose it, what label we put on it. So social influence, symptoms change over time. In other words, the symptoms someone has as a child will be different to when they're older. So a lot of cultural involved. So I've already said the caveat, which is watch out how much you diagnose everybody. Okay, so let's start on them. This is some of these. This is almost all childhood bound, the neurodevelopmental disorders, meaning they have to do with either genetic predisposition or they have to do with how someone's born or trauma that happens at birth and so on. So that's where you deal with intellectual disability is one of the first diagnoses in the DSM, and we used to call that mental retardation. So this is the low IQ differing levels of the ability to manage life. But really the marker is the low IQ. So someone takes an IQ test and they mark low. But it has to be pretty, there's different levels of low, even with intellectual disability, depending on the measure that they get from the IQ test and other tests as well. And then you get into communication disorders, language disorders, speech sound disorder, childhood onset fluency disorder. We call that stuttering. What you'll notice is we have very, very long medical-ish sounding terms now because they're trying to get rid of, how do we view the word stuttering? We've made fun of it forever and for decades, right? If you've ever seen The King's Speech, great movie on stuttering. So because certain words have become so stigmatized, the DSM has changed the names to get rid of the words that we would be more likely to laugh at. So hence the long childhood onset fluency disorder is actually stuttering. Social communication disorder. Autism is the one we know the most. We've had many, many movies, many characters and shows. You know individuals. It's there's what's happened in the, just so you know this, in the last 4 years, autism, 5 years, autism had an autism label, and then Asperger's was a separate label. But in the last 5 years, they've combined those two labels, and they've put them into the autism spectrum disorder. Asperger's would be on one end, and the more severe autism, where just being able to manage and live alone and things like that is on the other end. So it's now the autism spectrum disorder. And so a lot of parents went from being told their child had Asperger's to being told their child had autism. There's a lot of trauma during the years where this switched over and still is. Because autism has a huge, huge stigma or meaning. It creates a lot more trauma for parents when they hear about that word, much more scary. So it's just important to know that. What you'll see with autism, you'll see social communication difficulties, so that's looking in the eye, interacting socially. You'll see the restrictive, repetitive behaviors. That's what we see in the movies almost exclusively, the hand flapping and so on, the counting, the having to have things in a certain order. Yes, those are markers of certain kinds of autism, but there's a lot of individuals who might end up with an autism diagnosis that don't have any of those behaviors because those are not necessary for the diagnosis, okay? But that may be there in more severe. So it's all, the new DSM is all spectrum. The whole entire book is spectrum. So it goes from mild, moderate, severe. So same with autism. And then what you'll often see is a hyper or a hypo sensory response to sensors. So in other words, either they don't respond, like even when things are loud, they're just kind of not involved or not reactive, or the exact opposite, where they're hyper-reactive. And I need to change this because it just keeps flying all over the place. Okay, hold on for a second. Let's see if that helps. So what you'll hear often with autism is that loud noises, certain sounds cause a lot of reactivity in the individual with autism. So that would be the hyperreactivity to sound, and well, not just to sound, to sensory input. So that can be to smells, to tactile sensations, anything around the five senses that where there's a very strong reactivity to it. That's quite common with autism. Now, the most you'll hear about in the childhood onset, there's a few more after this, are the autism and the ADHD. So ADHD, there's a lot of controversy within the psychological community about ADHD. You've got the spectrum of responses to that. It does have some really clear markers laid out. Here's the list of inattention symptoms, and here's the list of hyperactivity symptoms. But what you have to realize is you have to have six of each of at least one of those in order to have that diagnosis. Well, most of the people doing the diagnosis for ADHD, the first people to mention it are teachers. They're the number one occupation that says, I think your child has. And then MDs are next, so this would be your pediatric. They are all, just so you know, all doctors, they're the first line of defense for all mental health, meaning your primary care doctor is the major person that people go to say, I'm experiencing these symptoms, and they're the major prescriber of the medications. But this is the challenge with that. They have, most of them, one class in mental health, a 15-hour class in mental health. That's less than I have. So a lot less than I have, because I have a whole degree in it, right? So a psychiatrist has way more years of training in these things. So it be aware that if you're wondering, well, my teacher said this, and my pediatric doctor, who might be just like the most awesome thing ever, hopefully they'll say, what I would recommend is you go to a specialist and have them do an assessment. Go see a psychologist who does assessments. So, because there's a lot of confusion around some of these. And if you're confused, go get a second opinion. If someone's saying to you to get a second opinion, maybe that's a good idea to listen to that. You might end up with the exact same diagnostic category. So there's a lot of reactivity around these, and I just want to be sensitive to the fact that many of you may have children with this diagnosis or family members with it, with ADHD specifically. And I think we just need to really be open about the communication around it. There are also in the DSM all the learning disorders. So this would be the reading and writing. All of those learning disorders are in here. So this is what the school psychologists use. The school psychologists use all of these. And the school psychologists use the top one there. Those are their main. They do all kinds of other things too. But they're continually testing for all of those. All right, what are the motor disorders? So this is lampooned quite a bit in our culture. The motor disorders would be if someone has, there are two different kinds. I'm sorry, I'm going to move this again because it just keeps wrapping around me. There are two different kinds of motor disorders. There's the motor, so this would be like when someone's doing different body tics where they keep repeating. I have individuals who, you know, they'll keep doing just a simple to the jaw every sentence or so, or every few minutes or so. So it might be a simple motor tic. It might be a much larger motor tic, which is the whole body. If you know the Jensen story, their son had a whole body motor tic that was causing, it causes problems in the back, in the neck, multiple different areas of the body. So the motor tics can be anywhere from small to the entire body, or they can have multiple motor tics. The difference there is you can have a motor tic disorder, but then you can also just have a vocal tic. So this would be where somebody makes different buzzing sounds or clicking sounds or say certain words over and over. So that would be a vocal tic. Those are separate disorders. When they're combined, they're Tourette's. Okay, so Tourette's is very serious. Tourette's is very challenging for people. Talk about suffering for the soul. Tourette's is really, really challenging for people. Now, yes, there's different lengths of severity. So this would be, say, the Jensen's son and the physical severity. But they are still going to class with those tics. They're going to work with those tics. And people are thinking, we have a young individual in our ministry who it's been diagnosed just recently. But those of us who have known this situation have seen it for a while, because this was a child that people thought was just being disruptive. But after a while, it was like, nah, this isn't disruption. There's something more involved here. And so he just received this disorder. Well, that's very devastating for a parent to hear that. It's also helpful for a parent to hear that, because all of a sudden they're getting a lot more support. So, again, the positives and negatives of diagnoses. And then there's the elimination disorders. So that is urine and fecal material. So that's where the... And you'll have... this is where sometimes you'll see only this, where they have a bedwetting and they go into their later years. What I'm not explaining on here is that there's years and length of time before you can give any of these diagnoses. You have to have it for 6 months, or you have to have it for this number of years, or you have to do it this many times a week. I'm not sharing any of those with you today. But most children have some form of enuresis, and most children have some form of encopresis when they're younger. It's when they get older and it continues that it's problematic, and it's usually involved with other disorders as well. So if you get a reactive attachment disorder, you're going to see quite a bit of these.
Is dyslexia going to be, is that one of the recognized?
This is one of the learning disorders. Dyslexia is a learning disorder. Yep. All of the reading and math, all of the learning disorders.
That is a recognized.
Yep. Yeah, that's not a specific disorder. It's included in the reading disorders. So it's a type. Yeah. Yes.
Also, as far as symptoms, they don't have to be all present.
They do not have to be all present.
Then the other way around, too, sometimes there's overlap of symptoms when ADHD
shares the same kind of... Right. So the way... And I'm going to explain that when we hit schizophrenia. So the way they laid out the book was they laid them so that... the new one, anyway, is they put them sort of close to each other when the symptoms overlap. So actually, autism and schizophrenia are kind of close to each other in the book because sometimes they have the same symptoms. And you go, which one is it? Okay, so those are rather different diagnostic categories. So yes, they overlap. So they've tried with the new DSM. What I'm showing you today is it looks like this. This is one diagnosis. This is the other. This is the other. That is not reality at all. They overlap. They tried to do what you call a lifespan. That's why I actually included that in the title. So today I'm giving you these are the specific things that you'll say to these, but it is not like that when you're actually diagnosing, and it's not like that when you're actually living with it. All right. So to explain it, I'm making it a little more categorical, but we've known for a while it's not categorical, but I think the world is catching up with that understanding. So, all right. So, who hasn't watched some movie with split personalities in it, right? We've all watched it. That's actually what's the most recent movie that just came out? Split. Well, there you go, right? I actually haven't seen it, and I really should. My kids are like, Mom, you need to see this movie. Split personality is the old term. It's a what? It's a negative term, right? It's a stigmatized term. So we have a different term today. Dissociative identity disorder. So that's where they have two different identities and they're very separate and so on. I'm not going to go into all of that. We're all fascinated with this one because it's in all the movies. We're fascinated with severe mental illnesses. There's movies I was just watching, Tim, what's the show we're watching now?
This Is Us.
I know, what? It's in all of them, isn't it? This is he goes back to try to keep Kennedy from getting shot. 63. So, and he's in an insane asylum and they're all, you know, it's been shown in the most famous movie is, what's the big, big one?
Beautiful Mind.
Well, that Beautiful Mind. I know, we can all just shoot them out. This is the older one.
Sybil.
I mean, right? I mean, there's just so many. I'm actually thinking of the... One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That's the one I'm thinking of. All of these, we are fascinated by severe mental health. So this would be where the ability to live what we would call a normal life is hugely impacted. And it is impacted. The reality is people with all of these disorders can live very rich lives. Sometimes it's very difficult to live on your own without an incredible amount of help. So, yes, these are, you know, once we get into the psychotic disorders, we are dealing with a lot more challenges to daily functioning. But there are disciples among you with some of these symptoms. So this is where it's important. We can be kind of funny about these, but there are disciples among us who have lived productive, fruitful spiritual lives with schizophrenia. So, and DID. So it's just important to realize that although these seem quite severe and in the movies, these are very real things. Most of us won't come across some of these things, but it's just important to include that since we're teaching on all of the disorders. Amnesia, we're familiar with that. Let me explain depersonalization. So all of these, DID, schizophrenia, and the psychotic disorders all include two different things. Depersonalization, which is where there's an experience of unreality, of being detached, of feeling like you're an observer of one's thoughts, of one's feelings, of one's body. So you feel depersonalized, like you're looking at your body. Now, the reality is this can happen when people are on drugs. Okay, so that's why they can't make a diagnosis sometimes until they get somebody off detoxing from a drug, because the drug can actually create all of these sensations as well. Illness can create this. You get people who go into having a surgery, and the different medications they're on during the recovery send them into some of these experiences. So again, very challenging, not just for somebody who might end up with this diagnosis.
Can all this be rooted in trauma?
We're gonna hit trauma for a bit, because I think a lot of it is rooted in trauma. Derealization is, so the difference between depersonalization is that you feel like you're separate from your body. With derealization, you feel like you're separate from everything around you. Meaning, you're looking down on this room, and you're seeing this room as if you're separate from this room. That's like a more dreamlike state, a more kind of a foggy state, very distorted visually. So depersonalization is outside of your body, derealization is outside of the room kind of idea. All of those are involved in the dissociative disorders, schizophrenia, and psychotic disorders. So, and they all overlap into delusions and hallucinations. And these are, again, can be drug-related, because drugs can cause delusions and hallucinations. Delusions are when somebody is very sure that what they believe is real, and they cannot be persuaded differently. So that's a little bit yeah, we could go into that for quite a while. But in other words, it's a belief that is quite distanced from reality. There are people that believe things that are quite possibly true. That's a whole different thing. This is something that's quite on the realm of impossibility. Even when they're shown evidence, they're like, nope, I'm absolutely sure it's true. And delusions can take on different flavors. They can be a delusion of that's the most common one is persecutions, that the government is against me, or my spouse is against me, or my coworkers are against me, or my neighbor is against me. So that would be a persecutory. Grandiose would be, let me make sure I get my wording right here. I am an individual that I have incredibly great abilities. I have a lot of wealth, and I have a lot of fame. So this is somebody, remember, this is something that is not true. So they don't have wealth. They don't have fame, right? But they think they do. Then you've got the referential delusions, which is when someone makes a gesture or a comment, or they see something in their environment, and it's about them. They say, oh, they're talking about me, and that gesture that they made, that's about me. So that's a referential delusion. And then erotomatic is the belief that someone's in love with me, and so on. I know that they're in love with me. You hear about this in the news quite a bit. You also have the nihilistic ones, which really has to do with everything is a catastrophe, it's going to occur. Now, mind you, all of these overlap into OCD and all the anxiety disorders. So you're all diagnosing yourself right now. Oh my gosh, I have schizophrenia. And then somatic is where you're pretty sure you're ill. Your body, everything you feel in your body means you're ill. So, you know, we might have called that hypochondria before. Hypochondria is actually no longer in the DSM, but the disorder is, just with a different name. All of these, so religious. So I work with individuals who most that come to see me are very committed religiously. And it's very challenging when the things they believe, and they're so sure they're true, I heard God. So, you know, is that a delusion, or is that just I felt like I was in the presence of God? It can be really hard, and we're going to talk about OCD as well. It can be really hard to separate what might be problematic and so on. I'm going to discuss the rest of these after a break. It is 9:49. We're going to break for 10 minutes and start again at 10.
So we're going to stop the tape and then rearrange things
Yes.
better for you?
Yes. I know. I keep fixing it.
I'll show you how to do it. You just press it once.
Right.
And it goes red.
But which one of these, which is this one? The one that was wrapping around? It's too loose. It was hanging down. I couldn't walk.
Oh.